Okay, Bob and Cameron are back, and this is the 16th edition of our exploration of my book/pamphlet, and we did the tiny note chart as a sidebar to so Cameron could get acquainted with some of the themes I was maybe thinking about or developing from while doing the book. Which leads to a new development called the Tech Body. Cameron and I said, or Cameron came up with this idea, he was, what is the question, Cameron, that you raised at the end of last week?
Well, actually, it was you that raised it, and that is the question of, was the tiny note chart based on McLuhan, or was McLuhan just part of the pattern within the tiny note chart?
First answer is no. It's not based on McLuhan. Each quadrant is an era, different proportions, as I show on the right side of the chart, whole different dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions, to quote McLuhan, from the McLuhan Hot and Cool book, around page 109 or so. In the hardcover version. And that yields the golden section in space or time. You remember that quote? It's a great quote.
Yep.
So I'm trying to show the dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions within the Android meme. So there's in the notation at the top of the chart, the five columns, under the terms Rye, Eloy, Too Lofty, and Bob, I have McLuhan references, Croker jargon, William Irwin Thompson themes, and LaRouche memes, say, and some of my stuff. So each quadrant's supposed to be rotating around the other. So there's not McLuhan as the ground. LaRouche. So one way I have it is that McLuhan is rhetoric, LaRouche is dialectics, Thompson is grammar, Croker is anarchism, Marxism, radicalism, not sure, but he's not. He could be quadrivial, geometry, arithmetic, and astronomy. So, and then the Dobbs quadrant is the electrification of these previous media, and then the digitization of them. So Dobbs is the ground. In a way, I'm the ground. But I try to make it the Android meme, and not me per se. But my talk about the Android meme is the ground. So
just hold there for a minute, because I'm still... I'm unclear about the Android meme. Is this, we talked about it being both singular and plural before, but I've never quite been able to understand if the Android meme is conceived by you as having a kind of personality. The Android meme, if I understand you properly, is organic, the taking over or the installation of consciousness in a new way. Is that correct?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
And
so,
yep. Go ahead.
So behind that question is, you know, when you talk about the four figures in the tiny note chart as being different kinds of different figures of speech, different exercises of mind, that's fine. But what I want to know is how these are being recognized as such, right? So the whole question of whether or not McLuhan is the ground of these things depends upon how the figures are being recognized relative to each other, right? What is the pattern recognition that is going on that can place the four of them in a certain pattern.
Okay, so each quadrant is more a technology than the human form. McLuhan is there, but he's merged with TV, and it's actually holopathic satellite TV. How do I say it here? Just get it right. Yeah, holopathic TV / satellite. LaRouche is subsumed into holopathic radio satellite. Thompson is subsumed into holopathic computer satellite. So the constituents, maybe you could say analog media, that make up the content of the Android meme, which is a digitizing process, that's a more major thing than the people. But because the Android meme is trying to be invisible and look like people, the human part, like a McLuhan, is seen more than the technology, which is how I see Joyce presenting the media in Finning's Wake. So it's modeled on my understanding of Finning's Wake. It's a big factor. You know the page, I think we've mentioned page 309 or so, the chapter right after the kid's lesson in school opens with a description of HCE, Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, indistinguishable from a radio of the 20s, say, 20s and 30s. So the human is merged. So Joyce, nowadays, we'd say, you know, he first saw the cyborgian situation, the term that was popularized, in the 90s. So, and then I want to show other factors, parts of nature. I'm merging everything into each quadrant. But each quadrant has a different ratio setup, sensory ratio proportions, and that's on
right,
the far
exactly.
right.
Exactly, and that's what's important to me, Bob. Let me put the question in a slightly different form. Let's say that we're reporters or interested students around 1800, and we're going around to different labs. And some of the labs are run by alchemists, and some of the labs are run by protochemists. And we're trying to figure out sort of what's going on. And so we talk to the alchemists, and we talk to the chemists, and we say, we want to know the story that's involved here. And the alchemists are ranging over all of human history, and they're talking about being able to explain everything that ever was, and they're talking about different spirits and different levels of explanation, all this sort of stuff. Very, very complicated stuff, but extremely comprehensive. And then you have the chemists, and the story there is we know almost nothing about everything. All we know is that we're beginning to understand that there appear to be some regularities that we never saw before, but they're reproducible in a way that none of the alchemical stuff is, right? And so these are the different stories going on, and the interesting question to me, at least, is how these different stories are to be described and evaluated. In terms of the question of the different people on a tiny note chart, for me, one way to look at these different stories is to find out from you, if you see a sentence or a paragraph from McLuhan, LaRouche, Croker, and Thompson, how do you know, and let's say these paragraphs are blind, right? What is it about them, aside from particular use of vocabulary, right? What is the structure of language in these paragraphs that allow you to say, this is LaRouche, or this is McLuhan, right? Because only when we know how you recognize these patterns Can we understand how you are caching a term like the golden mean between them?
Right. Now, you said a word there in there. I don't know what it was. I wanted to ask about that. So what's their difference? Their structure, their style?
No, what's the principle of recognition? What is it that you're doing? You as the chemical analyst, we could say, what is it that you're doing with these samples that then allow you to say, this sample works in this way, this sample works in that way?
I think I'm showing specialization.
Yeah, okay, good.
So that if you become a McLuhanite, you're going to look at things through media structures. And you're going to miss what McLuhan told me through channel to the Everings that he missed. He didn't understand that management could slow down the transformations of media, you know, just managerially stubborn holding things up.
Sure.
So he said he missed that
I
aspect.
Notice that those... what he saw and what he missed, those are on completely different levels, right?
Right.
I mean, the managers missing something or slowing down something, that still depends on what's going on with media. It's just that it's like the minus sign instead of the positive sign in front of media structures. So... I think you're right that McLuhan analyzes in terms of media structures, but there's a big question of what media are, and in my view at least, that's something that McLuhan research hasn't understood. So let's move on from McLuhan.
Okay, so what I would then say, if I'm going to talk about, think about the angle of management, I find LaRouche has a better explanation of how management slows it down. But LaRouche doesn't have much awareness of McLuhan's dynamics. And then Thompson comes in with something totally different. He comes from a Buddhist angle or a yoga angle. So I wanted to show different schools, I would say schools of thought and perception. Use both words. And how people got specialized. And I was trying to show how you overcome the specialization and that the Android meme had already done it right in front of us, presenting a non-specialized situation. And that's where you get different memes showing up and then disappearing and replaced by another meme.
Okay. So rephrase what I think you're saying. And you can tell me if I'm screwing up somewhere or missing something, okay?
All right.
So what I hear you saying is that McLuhan identifies certain structures that he talks about in terms of media. And he recognizes that the recognition of his analysis is subject to a bunch of factors. So if somebody is going to come to understand it, they have to go through a kind of transformation themselves because media aren't different from are already involved in the thinking of the person trying to understand media.
Yes.
So, and unless you go through a kind of flip where your mind comes to take account of media, you're never going to understand media, right?
Yeah.
So there's a flip in education that's necessary. And then there's also a flip in management.
Yes.
And the management flip can be seen very well in terms of chemistry, where what happened to achieve the victory of chemistry over alchemy is that when people in factories producing ink or producing gunpowder or producing paint in the course of the 19th century, they were able to use chemistry to either innovate or improve these manufacturing processes. And once the manufacturing processes took off, then that set in motion a whole chain of things behind them, right? The production of paint, for example, probably required certain products that themselves had to be produced chemically, right? And maybe that required a new kind of mining that also involved chemistry. So here, McLuhan might be seen as saying, okay, so you have the basic structures, and there's already a problem in education, but the real problem exists in management, at every level of management, including the management of human identity.
Yes.
And so, and that's what Take Today is all about.
Yeah.
So then he's recognized structures, and he looks, on the basis of structures, he looks backwards, you could say, to the problems of identifying them in the first place, and then he looks ahead to the problems of them being applied in economics and politics and whatever. Okay, good. So once we have that pattern, then you say of LaRouche, well, he understood better than McLuhan did what these problems of management are. And I say, yeah, I think that's right. So what we can do in terms of the diagram we were just thinking of in terms of McLuhan is we can say that looking into the future, LaRouche identifies problems of application, problems in economics and problems in politics that need to be taken into account in thinking about the one set of problems generated by the McLuhan diagram.
Yes.
Then you talk about Thompson. You say, well, it's a kind of Buddhistic outlook. And there you can say, well, there are these patterns, and those patterns not only have implications as regards education and how they would come to be learnt, and not only have problems in terms of their application throughout society, but they have metaphysical implications. And we have to begin to understand in a way that McLuhan either didn't have time for, didn't have interest in, or something. We have to understand better what the metaphysical implications are. And this goes towards the Catholic side of McLuhan and goes, say, to the Buddhist side of Thompson. And there the question is, what is the self-understanding of media? You could say it's like meta-chemistry as opposed to how chemistry gets learned in the first place and how chemistry gets applied throughout society. There's the question of how these physical structures are to be understood at the highest possible level, including questions of the Big Bang and the inflation after the Big Bang and all that sort of stuff. So there I would again see Thompson in relation to the diagram. And then you say, well, Croker is an anarchist, and that's probably right. So Croker might be associated with the McLuhan diagram we drew is by saying, well, both at the level of the, no, at all levels, at the level of learning, at the level of application, and at the level of higher understanding of these structures, there is a kind of implosion that goes on. So
yes.
there's no understanding of the structures by the individual without a kind of implosion in that individual, because the individual is always going to come to the learning of the structures from some other structure, right? There's no such thing as anything in the world that isn't chemical, and there's no such thing in the interior landscape that isn't already media. So unless media implode on the way to understanding media, then you're never going to get there, right? There's a necessary implosion. There's a necessary descent, like Dante makes, from being lost in the woods. Unless the understanding goes through this somersault, then it's never going to understand it, itself. And then at the higher level, the same thing occurs. That unless the Big Bang and black holes and all of the difficulties of understanding the interrelationship of the media forms, unless those difficulties are encountered, then there's no real understanding going on.
Right.
And similarly with the application. And so what that does is it situates the four people in relationship to each other, but it does so in terms of an underlying structure where I find McLuhan more informative than the others, in the sense that they all get situated in terms of something he put his finger on, but the others didn't.
Okay. The chart is based on the content of my book, Fatty Communion with Bob Dobbs, where I have a whole section of the better quotes from LaRouche, the better quotes from McLuhan, you know, in my opinion, and Thompson and Croker, and then a transcript of the kind of stuff I said on the radio in Toronto. So I showed this book to Thompson. I gave him a copy, and he got back to me. He says, "Bob, they're all the same." And he couldn't see how he was different from from the quotes, that he was different from Croker, McLuhan, and LaRouche. That was a crazy response. Says, "Bob," he's kind of complained, "this is just all same stuff." So
yeah.
He's the only guy. Croker never commented on the book. McLuhan was dead, and LaRouche was in jail.
right.
So,
but notice how Thompson's reply is already in the book, right? It's an uninteresting reply, in that basically what he's saying is, well, I'm a Buddhist, and I believe that everything at the end of the day is all one. And
all Maya. You know,
yeah, exactly. There's Maya, and then there's beyond Maya.
Yeah.
So it's all one. And so then and then he says, and my impression of your book is that it's all part of the one, right? I mean,
yeah. Good point.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
Yeah, I guess that was a Buddhist response. He fooled me by saying you're all the same.
Yeah.
Okay, then. I'm also, because it's the Android meme and not really my personal subjective projection, I take what I call the Madison Avenue version of McLuhan. Oh, he's a guy who said we live in a global village, and he had a crazy notion the medium is the message. So I would take the most cliche aspects of McLuhan, and that would be part of the McLuhan quadrant, and the most aspects of LaRouche. Oh, LaRouche is the... What did they say? He's a paranoid anti-Semite. You know, that would be the Madison Avenue version of LaRouche. And Thompson's a New Age flake trying to do yoga. Croker is ridiculous. You can't understand him. I don't know. We don't know what Croker's talking about. So those were aspects of it, too. So I'm having if you want to really understand Croker and read his books, I'm there to respond on that level. But I also include the level of general public ignorance and cliches. So you got those two aspects swirling around here, because I'm kind of trying to include every possible human response in this.
But when you say I'm trying, there's something else going on, right? I mean, you said it's not really me, it's the Android meme. So when you say I'm trying, really what you're...
I'm saying the Android meme is trying. I should say it that way.
Yeah, but you were also involved. So there's a kind of hiccup going on where
I'm in the cul-de-sac, man. It's hard to get out of it.
Right. That relates back, 15 or 14 conversations back, right? So we know that that's a very interesting topic to me. But let's just follow up this for a minute. The Android meme is generating memes. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
That's what it or he or she or they is all about.
I accidentally predicted what the kids live like now. I hear people talk about their millennial or younger kids, and they're all talking memes. They think they're communicating memes. And this person said, you know, that's not the original meaning of meme. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what he said. He said they've mutated it. And I think I was saying this couple times in the past 15 sessions that my terms won, at least in this time, in this generation, right? They use, they don't say, well, we got this virtual reality and that virtual reality, or this cyberspace or that. They say, well, here comes another meme. So the word, and it's an automatic technological process, has nothing to do with humans. Now, they think they're being talked to, but I say the Android meme is not talking to humans. It's extending itself within itself.
I understand what you're saying there, but what I don't understand is this use of the word I'm trying in relationship to you on the one hand and the Android meme on the other. It seems to me that there's this kind of hiccup where Bob is trying to, I don't know, mimic or to instantiate or to listen to or to reproduce or something like that, the Android meme, which in turn is trying to do something.
Yes.
And the Android meme's intentionality is difficult to understand in terms of its singularity or plurality. It
needs
to be inherently plural, in which case it's difficult to understand intentionality. Or it's not hard to understand plural intentionalities, but in that, once you have plural intentionalities, then it's difficult to understand the Android meme's singularity.
Yes.
Right? How can there be a kind of singular intentionality that is fragmented explosively into different intentionalities?
Well, you know, the fractal image, where you see the repeating pattern, but in between the showing of the completed pattern, which is repeated, there's this weird difference of image. So I call that the interval of fragmentation, and then it comes back to the same image, the same shoreline or something.
Right.
That shows...
That's what McLuhan calls inclusivity.
Right. And that shows an aspect of the Android meme. It became a popular image, the fractal. And that's a result of human embedment in their technologies. The technologies communicate back the thought frame they're going to have, like Newton's "the universe has a clock" or something. And that's part of McLuhan's ideas, that the mental images that the tribe comes up with are reflected from the apparatus. So I'm trying to show that this is an incredible apparatus we're living in now, and every institutional attempt to control it or understand it or preserve it or overcome it is a failure. That's why I have each quadrant is a Shakespeare tragedy, except for my quadrant, where I'm not a tragedy. I'm the play Henry V, the play that celebrates reasonably successful life, but also includes Prospero from The Tempest. So I'm saying that if you get my chart, in other words, Bob's presentation, Bob's formula, you have a chance of survival. So, you know, it's pretty ambitious intention of me. And then, but I would say it gets real complicated because the Android meme pretends to do that for you, for us.
Okay, so, but you see, when you say the Android meme pretends, obviously I can understand the words, but it's, as I said before, it's difficult to understand that intentionality. It's difficult to understand that in terms of your intentionality, what the relationship is between the two of those. And it's difficult to understand that singular intentionality of the Android meme when a meme is never singular. It's inherently plural. Are you saying that common to the Android meme intentionalities plural, there is a kind of cloaking intentionality common to them all?
Maybe common to them all, but remember, the radio quadrant is paranoia. So I've got emotions, weird states, paranoia, McLuhan's schizophrenia.
But again, that complicates intentionality.
Right. And what's Thompson is hysteria, Croker is panic, and Dobbs is ecstasy. To the degree that ecstasy is an epiphany, or an epiphany is a good feeling, I'm putting myself into, well, I'm the guy that you can bypass the other quadrant's biases.
So let's look at, if we think about the etymology of ecstasy, right? You've got the X, going out from, and then the stasi is related to static or to standing.
Yeah.
And so ecstatic is to go out from a place. It's ecstasis is actually closely related to existence, right? It has to do with the state of existence itself that is excitable.
Yeah.
Right? There's something about existence that's always already outside of itself.
Yes.
Right? So in Indo-European languages, the whole concept of being has to do with this inherent excitability, growth, you could say, that can be seen from plants, or even the crystallization of minerals or something, up to mind, where everything is always kind of leaping out of itself. And it's this leaping out of itself that is the answer to what is existence or what is being.
Yeah.
And the strange thing about existence is that it not only leaps out of itself as and into life, it also leaps out of itself from life, and so death. So the if we think about this in terms of the sort of diagram that we had of the relationship of McLuhan and the other three guys, where at least in my interpretation, McLuhan kind of identified what they all were dealing with in a certain way. If we try to relate what you're doing to that chart, it seems to me that you're saying that you have a way of dealing with the problems that are inherent to those dynamic media forms.
Yeah.
There's a problem of education. How are they to be learned when there's an inherent somersault involved? How are they to be applied / managed in the future to economic, political, war and peace, et cetera, terms? And then at the higher level, how are they to be sort of self-understood? And LaRouche and Croker and Thompson, at least my interpretation, can be seen as specializing in different aspects of those problems. So
yes.
Then if there is a fifth figure in all this that seems to be sort of going back and forth between Bob Dobbs and the Android meme,
yeah,
and it's never clear if this is a singular identity or multiple identities, and that applies both to the Bob side and to the Android meme side, that there seems to be a fifth take on this,
yes,
on this dynamic figure.
Yeah.
So maybe what you could do is you could talk a little bit about how the how you see those aspects being either clarified or conceived in a new way that allows their solution.
Right. Okay, so so say something about each one of them. Funny, you say. Oh, that reminded me. So many thoughts that I'll get a thought, and so I want to say that, but then it gets bumped out by something else.
Yeah.
The original, one of the original purposes was to overwhelm the viewer, because this is what the typical cliche of it. We live in a world of information overload. And then I wanted to say, well, it's actually organized. And if you figured out some kind of structures, you'd wouldn't be so overwhelming. So the idea was to start to know. You'd have to read McLuhan and Thompson and other things. You have to become almost a polymath. And have to do your homework to be able to overcome the Android meme. But at the same time, I'm trying to save time. So, you know, statements that McLuhan made about education were in my mind. So on the educational level, the purpose, the pedagogical level, McLuhan might dominate that. But LaRouche had a lot to say about that, but not so much Croker and Thompson. They didn't talk about how to deal with the students too much. The problems McLuhan came up with, how to save the student time, how to get them to see some patterns, how to get them to note that traditional culture is relevant the way they think comic books are relevant. So all those issues. Mm-hmm. But they're always undermined under Android meme conditions by the Android meme. So it's an obituary. It's a, what McLuhan would call, it's forensic. It's an analysis of the corpse. But what is the corpse? So I have consciousness in the LaRouche quadrant. Then I've got Orphic Baroque spirals. Sorry. I've got God, whatever that is, as a concept, but a concept, I guess, or a percept. It's illustrated within the LaRouche quadrant as God is dead. So I had a scream in the street about God, and then McLuhan about sex. If it feels good, do it. Politics. The whole world is watching. Consciousness in the Croker quadrant. Staying Alive, which is a reference to that disco movie by John... Oh, yeah, McLuhan called them... I'm remembering the name by remembering what McLuhan called them. Revolta. Yes, that's John Travolta. Staying Alive. And then in the Dobbs quadrant, it's quoting a Saturday Night Live skit with Julia Child, the famous chef. And they in the skit have her going in the skit saying, "Save the kidney." Now, I know I've said this stuff in previous hours, so again, I'm repeating myself, but I may not know how to go beyond the basic themes as I repeat. So God, sex, politics, consciousness, and Orphic Baroque spirals, the spiraling of each one of these quadrants is what the Dobbs quadrant is supposed to show you, because Dobbs is the underlying structure. So I'm trying to show information overload, trying to show that you can, what appears to be information overload can have recognizable order, almost simplistic repeating order, and it's also going to some evolution or some breakthrough. What do they call that? Teleology. What is that philosophy?
Teleology.
Yeah, teleology. And
telos means a goal in Greek.
Right, right. A purpose or a singularity.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to predict what's actually coming in the new technologies based on Carolyn's experience with this AIDS breakthrough, which was such a breakthrough, society couldn't recognize it, couldn't adopt it. And then there's all those problems, management problems on that level of, no, that put too many people out of work, you know, we can't bring it in that fast. So
Just one quick question. I don't want to break your thought, but when we were talking about telos, you said, okay, yeah, that's the goal, that's the purpose, and then you used a word I didn't understand, but it could have been singularity.
Yeah, I said singularity.
Okay.
Dramatic.
That's fine.
But what is that? Isn't there a philosophy that doesn't use the word teleology, but means that? I'm just trying to think, what was that? Am I thinking back in the 80s and 90s, I used to see the term. Is teleology almost a cult? People...
No.
Yeah.
Teleology is more like theology or something like that.
That was it. Cosmogenesis or something. Anthropogenesis.
Okay.
You ever heard of that?
Yeah, sure. Those are one understanding of teleology.
Yeah.
Right? Teleology is like theology in that there's a thousand possible theologies, and there's a thousand possible teleologies.
Yeah. And so one of them is, I think it's anthropogenesis or something. That's the movement that the universe is for man, for humans.
It itself is human.
Is what? Is human.
Human.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but, you know, the extension of the planet through the satellite made humans identify with animals because they both were mammalian content in a new, as he says in War and Peace and the Gold Village, a new super terrestrium. What was this phrase? Super macrocosmic something. page 190, if you have War and Peace there. Macrocanubium. You remember that? He ends the book with the phrase, the word canubium.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a pretty dramatic statement on the last page. So beg your pardon?
I was just going to say it's a vision of inclusiveness.
Yes. And so the result of the satellite, he would first say it brought in ecology, but one of the dramatic effects was people really started worrying about seals and whales and animals and preservation of nature, because there was a new sympathy between all of nature, moving nature, walking around nature, inside this new weird situation of the satellite extending the planet. So,
right.
So
that's just one meme, right?
There's
all sorts of other memes that are competing with that.
Right. But the new meme came in. It was like a new one due to the satellites, where I added a new wrinkle.
Yeah.
And people, they would argue over what you would kill to eat. And but, yes, there was other kinds of interpretations. So it's almost like I'm presenting the only news report, okay? We don't need to listen to the news every day.
<All right.
laughs> We're going to do it once, and we're going to focus on Bob's news report.
I'm going to read you what Ion had to say at this. This is at the very start of his last go-around about the Book of the Dead.
Oh, great.
Here's I'll read you what Ion says. But remind me that I want to come back to the question of whether in your last, in your last series of explanations, if you actually said anything that went to my question. Because I think that you didn't.
I never get to the question.
Okay. So here's Ion. He says, the thing that comes into play here that you all are judged by is you all are trying to play this time thing. The craziest thing we've ever seen. I don't know how. You can't prove it. You can't validate it. You can't mark it. It keeps changing. It keeps flipping. No day is the same length of time. No year is the same length of circle. It's insidious. Some days are fast. Some days are slow. Christmas comes but once a year, and it's slow as molasses. And then trouble comes so fast you can't get out of it till you're right back into it. It's crazy how this slippage goes back and forth. It's not based on anything. So you all got time against you. It's not on your side, right? So.
It's great to hear Ion. It's very nice that you quote Ion.
There you go. Yeah, but I take Ion there to be saying exactly what I keep objecting to your, what you just called your news report. That is your report on something new under the sun that comes about through satellites.
Right.
And I say there cannot possibly be anything new under the sun, because everything has its genesis out of basic forms that are synchronic. That is to say, they're timeless compared to the time that we live, but they're not timeless in lacking time. They have their own time, synchronic time. So there can't possibly be something new that emerges because of satellites. All that can happen is for existing possibilities to be energized in new ways.
Okay.
Right?
What is the most common perception today? Oh my God, we got to get back to normal. This is too new. This is crazy. Nobody knows what's going on anymore. People think that there's a newness happening. They don't like it, but there's a newness. Where did that come from? And, of course, that's an effect of media or of management, the oligarchs putting out a meme that make people think this is new. Or what would the Buddhists say? The Buddhists say, all is Maya.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Croker would take advantage of the confusion and spread anarchy.
Correct. And so all of these are ways of talking about a difficult situation at the level of history. And, of course, the level of history now is very, very complicated because of new media and because of atomic weapons, et cetera, et cetera.
But what's the same? You're implying there's something new there.
But imagine, no, but let's just imagine that you're in Constantinople around 1400 or something, and for centuries you've been more or less under siege, and you're constantly getting your walls bombarded by ever bigger cannons that the sultans are buying from Europe, or they're manufacturing themselves. And some of these cannons are so big that even if your wall is 20 feet thick, which some of them were, they can put a cannonball right through that, right? And so night and day, boom, boom, falling walls, and then you've constantly got thousands and thousands of people that are in, their whole lives are spent repairing walls. So imagine the panic, imagine the difficulties of dealing with this, right? So it's not as if human anxieties are new, right? It's part of the memes of media, media understood in a sort of naive sense, as television and newspapers and all that sort of stuff, and the internet. It's part of the message of media that what's going on is new, and unless you tune into what we're saying or what we're reporting today, you're going to not understand what life is all about because there's something new happening, right? But of course, at the deepest level, Thompson is absolutely correct that there's nothing new under the sun. It's all the same. Humans cannot possibly have some kind of new situation because humans forever have been in extremis, right? To be the first hominin ancestors that we have back in Africa somewhere, the only way that they were able to survive and be our ancestors was that they went through the only way that we're able to propagate who we are. That is to say, the humans, like animals, exist through extreme situations of especially birth and death, but also sickness and hunger and things in between. And those things do not change. Those things, there's a baby being born is always hanging by a thread of dying. And up until a certain time in history, I don't know if it was 1700 or something, but it was fairly late, probably the majority of children that were born did not live.
Yes.
Right? It was a terrible situation. And there was no human being that did not terminate. Right? That was built into their fate as well. In famous considerations of what it means to be human, like those of Sophocles, for example, it's never, ever far from their thought that human beings are hanging by this thread. And so this thread that can, you know, one of the three Greek fates is the cutter. Right, it's she has some scissors, and as the thread is spun by the other faiths, she cuts it. And she sometimes cuts it short, and she sometimes cuts it long. But every one of us is, you know, a threat. So I say that to get away from the idea that it's helpful by way of explanation about the human fate. It's not helpful, in my mind at least, to say, well, the satellites did this, and the biology, medicine did this and that, because that really doesn't answer the fundamental problems. And those fundamental problems are not only seen in the difficulties of every human life, but they're also seen in the practical aspects of media forms that we talked about earlier. So in terms of education, for example, this flip that people have to go through is involves a kind of appreciation, it involves willy-nilly. Most people would never, I think, come to think of it in these terms, but this, the flip that you go through in order to think about thinking appropriately, has to do with this thread that we're talking about and the cutting of that thread. As human beings are exposed to nothing, to the no man's land, that, as McLuhan talks about it, inherently. So when you were talking about the purpose of your book was both to overwhelm and to simplify.
Yeah.
Right? You want to overwhelm with the number of memes and the extent of the memes, but at the same time you want to simplify that and show the pattern. It seems to me that what you're doing is you're naming the problem, but you're not contributing significantly in that description to its proper naming. Right? You're failing the Rumpelstiltskin test, if you want to put it that way.
Yes, but it was McLuhan, cite his quadrant, who said, when you can name something, you control it. So I thought this chart was a new kind of naming. And does he say communication is a miracle, or communication of the new is a miracle, but not impossible? Intake today. I think he says of the new, communication of the new.
It may be. Certainly, that's a fine way of describing what we've been talking about as the educational problem of this flip.
Right.
Yeah. So you could say that a minute ago I was saying that inherent to that flip is a tie to this thread problem of human life, of the thread of fate that overhangs every human life.
Yes.
And it overhangs but also underlies, right? The miracle, if you will, is that there can be an understanding of the new that is seen in the birth of a child, and then in that child coming to speak. The speaking is not something that's based on what the child knew before.
Right.
A spark happens,
yeah,
and there's speech, right? Just as a spark happens and there is a child.
Okay, let me say this. How much you've been talking tonight.
Yes, more than before, I believe.
This is, you set a record already. We're only halfway through. Later, when Ian showed up, 14 years after the chart, but I have to add another year, because I didn't know what I could do, or I didn't understand what I was dealing with for another year or so. So 15 years later, I said, wow, the tiny note chart predicted, well, and the formula chart, predicted ion, not the Mir technology that Carolyn had in New York in 95. It predicted better technologies that we were making. So there's the whole aspect that something new did happen, ion. And ion is the strangest phenomenon ever.
Ion's not new, right?
What do you mean? Oh, yeah. Well, non-physical has never spoken to humanity like ion says it's doing.
Okay, but the non-physical is not new.
No, there's always been non-physical, but what happens, non-physical merged. It canceled its environment, which was called the guff, the non-physical. A big part of it was the guff, a Jewish word for heaven. And it has merged with Earth, the great prophecies of different religions, that somehow the great out there merges with the great hell of where we are. And that's the new situation. As a matter of fact, Ian just started saying this past week that grace has been canceled for humans. Now, what? That's pretty dramatic. We all depend on grace or imagine it or make something out of it. It ain't happening anymore. Uh-oh, what's that? And I haven't explored it much, just heard the headline. And I will do it in a few hours because on Thursday I have my weekly session with Ian, which is at least 3 hours. So I'll be going into that.
You can ask him if grace has been canceled. How does that relate to what he said about time?
Right.
Those canceling and is inherently time bound.
Yeah, that's right. No, I call Ian on that all the time, and he says, "No, Bob, we don't." We don't believe in time, but we do accept timing. Timing. Think of that. That's your dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions.
Yeah, so, the dynamic symmetry among proportions is sort of the topic that we've been talking about all night.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
And I don't, personally, I'm not able to see how you or the Android meme is in talking about that dynamic symmetry. I don't see how you are going beyond ecstatically what McLuhan already said.
Well, yes,
and
not Roush.
Only McLuhan, but lots of other people.
Yeah, and Roush and Thompson and Croker predicted aspects of this cold breakthrough. Now, what was I going to say about Ion? There was another aspect. Yeah, so if you ask Ion what happened in 1863, he says, we don't do time, Bob, so it doesn't work. So what you have to do is you go, well, during Queen Victoria's second half of her reign, what was going on? Then he'll do it. If you name someone and a context, then he can talk about it. But you can't use numbers, even though Ion says that pi has been stabilized. Just experienced a guy talking today, pi 22 over 7, and he had a whole theory of number and all that. But he had not been informed that pi is no longer unbalanced and infinitely going on. It's been balanced by something that's happened. It does include the 26,000-year cycle. You know, that the Aztecs, or the Aztecs, Incas, or, no, the Mayans. The Mayans discovered. With iron, you spiral off into a lot of different thought systems. Now, what was incredible is, even though iron thinks that I have to say this. Iron says, no, many people haven't died. We don't hear about them much. Saint Germain never died. Leopold II of the Congo in the 19th century, his wife, a great inventor that no one knows about, she didn't die. Anyways, the point that we die, Ion's questioning. But then it becomes a matter of whether they accept that or not. So a lot of new comes from Ion, or at least stuff we haven't heard about very much. It turns out, after putting up with a year of Ion denigrating McLuhan and Croker and LaRouche and all these people, why? Because they died. If you die, you get canceled off significant person in LaRouche's reality. I mean, in Ion's reality. So, but what happened? We found out a couple of years into it that my tiny node chart is in the Book of Revelation. This chart is way beyond anything we've ever heard about so far, according to Ion, if Ion's right, and it'll be unfolded over the next 10 years or so. So I've accomplished something amazing, but I got a lot of help from angels, Ion said. And angels don't like humans, so I don't know why they help me. Oh, that brings in another factor. Apparently, I'm the dark soul. Now, what's the dark soul? The dark soul is someone who is leading humans to victory over the angels in our war with the angels. Now, this wasn't said about me till the last couple of years, first 8 or so years. Nobody knew this. So I've got some crazy stuff being said to me in this situation. And I find that the chart kind of prepares us for it, which is interesting. So there's Go ahead.
Yeah, let me interrupt you here. When you talk about stuff that you find about the chart.
Yes.
Like a tie to the Bible, let's say. This seems to me to relate to the whole question of the chart's intentionality.
Yeah.
Because if what's going on in the chart is you kind of channeling the Android meme, or the Android meme channeling you, it probably works both ways.
Yeah.
Then the then it becomes possible to understand your chart and your thinking as hologram, where the patterns get repeated, but they get repeated in ever new ways, or at least in ways that haven't been recognized before.
Yes.
Right? So to me, that says that at the level of 1995 or 1996, whenever it was, the chart was done, 95, okay, that's when it appears in the magazine. Is that right?
No, it appears in 96, but it was okay. It was produced. There's a video of me in California explaining it to some people, and that's in 95.
Okay, good. So in 1995, there is some kind of what we could say is a meta meme going on that is a kind of cloud of other memes.
Yes.
And it's difficult to say if this is Bob or if this is the Android meme because the cloud has inherently a whole series of faces within it. But because Bob was the author, in quotes, of the chart, then Bob's face is prominent.
Did you say face? F-A-C-E? Bob's face?
Yes.
Yeah. Bob's face. That's right.
And so maybe there's Bob's face, and then through Bob's face, then a whole bunch of other faces. you could say it's like a prism where the light goes through the prism, and then you see the spectrum behind it, something like that.
Yeah.
But at any rate, in 1995, as opposed to 2010 or 2015 or 2021. In 1995, there's something going on that allows
the chart to manifest.
Yeah. So, but I don't like to say the manifestation in the sense of some revelation. I would prefer to see manifestation as something that is inherently shaped, right? The manifestation always implies manifestation of. And
yeah.
So what the chart is like a question. It's a manifestation of a whole bunch of stuff that can be associated with a whole bunch of different faces. Prominent faces are McLuhan, Croker, Thompson, and LaRouche, and Bob. Those are prominent faces, but they're only representative faces. There's behind them and included
subatomic particles.
Pardon me?
Behind them, there's subatomic particles.
Yeah, but there's also a million other faces.
That's right.
Like Zappa, for example.
Yeah.
And then behind that, more and more and more faces. Okay. So what this is a manifestation, and you could say it's a manifestation of memes, but the whole thing is a question because manifestation is inherently manifestation of something.
Yes.
Right? And the of something is what is,
the question.
In my mind, the important thing that's going on.
Yes.
That's why I kept on asking you in previous conversations, what is it about this chart that is limited, that points beyond itself, right? And I don't think you ever really dealt with that question.
I'm starting to deal with it by bringing in these other notions I haven't told you about.
All right, that's good. That's good. I'm not saying that everything should or even can be revealed or stated in a second.
Right.
Conducting a conversation here, and the conversation needs to be one that is constantly trying to probe deeper, but doesn't do so in some sort of airy-fairy way.
Right.
It does so by asking specific questions about the use of words, or about where something is headed, or whether or not something has been forgotten. And in this way, it's like going into the dark but being very sure about where you're placing your next foot.
Yes, we don't want anybody to get hurt, but it is a kind of an initiation. And note, in 95, for me, in my understanding of the spread of computers, it started around 95 with Netscape. That's when a lot of people got on the net. Can you say that, 95?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's when our company went from, we had gone through an evolution of floppy disks to CDs, and in 1995, 1996, that's when we first went online.
Yeah, was that due to Netscape for most people?
I think so. The reason that people were getting online was for the You've Got Mail phenomenon.
Yeah. Yeah.
AOL.
Yes. And so AOL and Mosaic did something in 93. What was Mosaic?
Yeah, I think that was an early Google-like way of indexing the information that was available online.
Okay. So Like McLuhan says, here's an interesting distinction. I wasn't responding to the Internet. I was responding to the environment of the Internet, which is Iandom, which was going to come 15 years later.
When you say that something is coming 15 years later, what you're saying is that the chart was limited in certain ways, right? It's very important for us to understand, if we want to understand how you came to an evolving understanding of your own chart, it's necessary to understand in what ways it was limited, or your understanding of it was limited, so that it was possible for you to have new understandings.
Yeah. And so that's what we're initiating here. New factors. But so McLuhan would say that the famous example of Seurat, S-E-U-R-A-T, the French painter, he created pointillism, and then those points, McLuhan said, anticipated the 1950s cathode ray tube TV image, the black and white image. So
he's not speaking. That's just kind of throwaway stuff from McLuhan. It's an unthinking attempt to try to get people to look at what they're doing in a new way. The poor guy. If he tried to talk specifically, people's eyes would just glaze over, and it wouldn't mean anything. And so he would be on TV with a million people watching, and they would ask him questions, and he would have to say something, and so he would say stuff like that.
Yeah, well, I like that stuff. It was fun. Yeah, he came up with good lines, good jokes.
Good
patterns.
Oh, that reminds me of an important point. I saw something on your site from somebody. Oh, I know. You had recommended a three-part discussion of, I can't remember if it's you and, I think it's you interrogating Ion, and it's a three-part series where you say that something like Ion explaining himself or something. I'll see if I can find it on your site so you know what I'm talking about.
Is this where I explain Ion's methodological manner of communication?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that's a new one. That's a new post, yes. Yeah, what happened? When the show ends, 12-hour show, we have what's called a tailgate. Do you know that term, tailgate, from football games and stuff? You know what that means?
Yeah, of course.
So we have a tailgate where people, we're not being broadcast anymore. The radio station is broadcasting something else, but we all can stay on the phone, which we were on during the show, and keep talking. And I'll go another 5 or 6 or 7 hours. So that's where I get to hold forth while Ion's been holding forth for 12 hours generally. You know what I mean? So I get to, quote, dominate. And Ion had brought up a new point that there are emotions in matter or in the periodic table, in elements. And that triggered a whole bunch of stuff for me that integrated everything that he'd been saying since 2009. So I was able to add this new pattern and explain all of Ion and also talk like Ion. I was actually becoming his style of communicating and quadriphenically jumping all over the place. And it got recorded. So we took that recording and put that out this past week. That's what you would have seen on maybe the front page.
I didn't listen to all of it, especially the last hour. After about 5 minutes or something, it just didn't seem to me to be something that I was going to listen to. But
okay.
The first two I did listen to, and one of the it wasn't just you speaking. There were people questioning or commenting, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the people said something I thought was very interesting, but I didn't really understand the situation in McLuhan. So person said, according to McLuhan, amusement is the only possible strategy. And that's a wonderful comment in my view, but I don't know where it's to be found in McLuhan. So maybe you could offer that as a question at some point.
Well, remember his in the 50s, it might be Thinking Through Language, the little pamphlet he and Carpenter did. He says, basically saying education has to be entertaining. But he says it better. He says something about education because it pleases the most if it's entertaining. And you have to please them for them to take it in. Do you remember that idea?
Well,
you don't remember that?
Vaguely. But I don't think McLuhan says something like that seriously.
Oh, I'll have to get the quote. He says that. He says, you know, education is one thing, but it has to entertain or it won't work. It's got to have an entertaining factor.
Right. But it's not as if McLuhan knew very well that entertaining students by itself wasn't going to work.
No, you have to figure out how to make it entertaining. And it's not obviously entertaining. It must please people or they won't take it in.
So,
and that would be rhetoric. That's the five types of the five parts of rhetoric. You know, how do you influence somebody that's listening, that's responding to you? You got to inventio, memory, dispositio, elocutio, you know, pronunciatio.
Right.
You got to the five things, get it together.
That plurality is very important. So I'm not denying that McLuhan said, not only said, but also acted in ways correlated to what this person said that McLuhan said. My point is that I would love to find that quotation. I mean, and now it could be that he didn't say amusement is the only possible strategy. He could have said humor, or he could have said comedy. But the association of amusement / comedy / humor with strategy, I think, is very, very important. And I wish if there is a direct quotation about that, I would like to know to find it.
Okay, well, I'll look for that one that I'm thinking of, Thinking Through Language, and that may not be it. But what's interesting, these are people, they haven't read much McLuhan, but they've heard me talk about it through the years, so you get quite a hallucinating interpretation of McLuhan, you know, which is fun.
Uh-huh.
People are making sense.
Yeah.
And so that's what happens on the show. There's a lot of making sense going on, and funny things are said by people.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They think they're making mundane sense, and they don't know the great McLuhan scholar Cameron Cure says, "Oh my God, that person hit it! We've got to find that." You know that quote. They'd be surprised that you were quote impressed, or thought it was pretty neat. But just on the surface, McLuhan did. Remember he said, "I'm a Pat Paulson." He cited a comedian as what he was doing. And
yeah.
Particularly of a comedian who was running for president.
Yeah. in I think it was 1962 when he was at the Festival of Life at USC, or Festival of Arts, I'm sorry, at USC, he self-identified as a comedian. He's, Rich Altman in Winnipeg has a tape of him saying, "I'm a comedian." Right?
Now, what is University of C? Calgary?
USC, University of Southern California.
And there's a transcript or a tape of him saying something. I don't think I've heard that. And he says, "I'm a comedian."
Correct.
Now, here's the point. He says it once, and he'll say everything else every other time, and he's consciously dropping, "Here comes everybody," in there. You know what I mean? He says, mm-hmm. "Okay, this is the place where I'm going to say that, and I'll never say it again, or not for another 5 years," but he'll drop it in there for us to discover.
Yeah. Well, they, one of the ways that you like to report the news is to attribute a kind of meta intentionality to people. Right? I'm a little suspicious of that myself. I think people have got plenty to think about just at the ordinary level without having to worry about being meta intentional.
Well, what's it mean to study to communicate with certain effects in mind?
Yeah. But
look, wanted to say he was a comedian at that point for some reason. Maybe probably Telstar caused it. the hit song Telstar. Remember that? The song about Telstar
I remember Telstar, but I don't remember.
Yeah, there was the number one song. Telstar was an instrumental in about '62. So I'm just taking something of pop culture that communicated something to McClellan. He says, now's the time to say I'm a comedian. I consider him a great actor in a way. He was a new kind of actor that people didn't know he was acting. And
nothing wrong with that, of course. That was one of the great attachments between him and Shakespeare, that he consciously thought that we were just masks on the stage. His mother had taught him that very early.
Yeah. I like that quote from Rabelais in Gutenberg Galaxy. Rabelais, you know, Rabelais, 1500s or so, he demanded everybody to put down their plow or their hoe and study his book that he was putting out.
Right.
You know, everybody had to stop what they're doing and pay attention. That kind of megalomania, McLuhan understood or felt himself, and sometimes it would come out. And maybe I picked up on some of that, too, more than your timid academics, because they can't talk that way.
But all of these people, Rabelais, McLuhan, and Dobbs, are talking about the fabulous never before seen in the history of the world and the importance of their stuff as a put on.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, everybody does it knowing that Rabelais already did it. And Rabelais already knew that Aristophanes had done it, right?
Yes.
And on and on.
Yeah, like Rabelais, he knew with print coming in, this is it's going to be harder to be heard, this great tradition, the Menippean tradition. So I've got to really get a little more extreme about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know that quote is from this British guy around 1968, interviewed McLuhan, and it's like a little booklet that the guy put together. I've got letters in their correspondence sending that up. Barry Day or Barry Dry or something, and it has on the cover, "I'm the only person who knows what's going on." You remember that quote?
Yeah, I have that too. I think it is Day.
Yeah, Barry Day, a British guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he caught that statement, if McLuhan did say it. You know, Barry could have hallucinated on it, misinterpreted something, but that's quite a statement, isn't it? "I'm the only one who knows what's going on." Isn't that a bit of a stepping up from Rabelais or from Joyce? Isn't that he's going further than what anybody ever said before?
Well, in a certain sense, but it's self depreciating, right? It's to say that is to include all human experience as asserting its monumentality, you could say. Right? Nobody spends their life in a corner saying, I'm not important, nothing I say is important, right? No, everybody goes out and is constantly enunciating things that they think of as world important. And it's totally meaningless. It has no importance whatsoever. But they need monumentality,
yes,
just like they need air.
Yeah.
So
the human comedy.
Yeah, so, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That's pretty good. So McLuhan took that nature, that human nature, human cliche, and he upped the ante by rubbing in everybody's face.
Sure, sure.
A comedian.
But the reason, let me mention the reason I thought that your auditor or questioner, whatever,
yeah,
they're called, the reason I thought it was so good. Amusement is the only possible strategy, or humor or comedy is the only possible strategy, is I've often thought that the United Nations or somebody should set up an office, and the office should be for something like it should authorize or issue, that's the word I'm looking for. It should issue certificates for when you can take over the assets of another country, right? And the idea would be, my idea would be, the United States would, that the United Nations would set up this authority. And this authority would allow the takeover of somebody else's assets. And the United Nations would authorize United States as the sole country able to administer that office, right?
Yeah.
So, for example, let's say that China comes along and proposes to the United Nations that that such an office be set up, right? The idea would be to use amusement or comedy to make a point at the United Nations as a strategy,
yeah,
that could, to make a point that cannot be made in any other way.
Right.
If you try to say, oh, United States is taking somebody's assets and that's wrong, then you know what's going to happen. The United States and 15 other countries are going to veto it in the Security Council.
Yeah.
And if 200 nations vote to not allow that office, and one votes to have the office, namely the United States, then it doesn't make any difference. Nobody cares what happens in the General Assembly. You can vote whatever you want in the General Assembly.
Yeah.
It has no effect.
Right.
Nobody reports it. Nobody cares about it. Right? It's supposedly the great parliament of the world, and it's meaningless. Right? And the only strategy that could possibly do anything about that situation is humor.
Yeah.
So I like the statement in terms of strategy as being something very, very practical. And McLuhan did make practical proposals all the time, and nobody paid any attention to it, right? So if somebody had, on the basis of what McLuhan was talking about, if somebody had invested just a few cents in what he was talking about, they would be a gazillionaire now, right?
Yes, yes.
I mean, he predicted the importance of information and then the importance of dialogue between ordinary people and on and on. And everybody just completely ignored it. There was nothing that he said in those terms that made any sense to people whatsoever. So he goes to General Electric, and he says, look, you're in the business of information, and you have to understand what these light bulbs you're making, what they're really about, and all that sort of stuff. And General Electric thought, oh, this guy knows absolutely nothing about anything we can use. And so here we are 40 years later, and General Electric is going broke because they didn't know anything about that stuff.
Right.
And similarly with Kodak, and similarly with Studebaker, and on and on, right?
Yeah. It's like McClure was the most right human being in recorded history.
Yeah, that's correct. But there have always been people like that who simply reported what was going on that nobody else could see.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? And maybe that's one of your claims about the tiny note chart.
Yeah.
Either you or the Android me is simply commenting on the passing show. But then it turns out that the comments on the passing show are investment worthy.
Like now, this is exactly what I have been saying lately. He said, Bob, everybody knows that you've been considered insane for years, okay? He says this. He says, but what's frightening now is you're beginning to make sense. Because the world has gone so crazy.
Correct. Correct.
So, yeah, I insist. And he also makes all kinds of financial claims about myself. So I've come to my apotheosis. So that reminds me, I hope I can find this quickly. There's this guy that younger guy. In 2011, Andrew Christ and I did a year-long celebration of McLuhan's centenary, and we were at the end of the year, we were going to have a conference here in Maui. Well, only one or two people showed up. Andrew couldn't even make it. And this was a younger guy from Los Angeles, so that was easy to fly over from L.A. So then we kept talking, but he discovered Leo Strauss and some woman who corresponded and argued with Wyndham Lewis, and he wasn't into McLuhan yet, but he kept going around the world of McLuhan, reading these other more obscure people and coming up with crazy ideas. And he eventually got himself so worked up that he ended up thinking the whole world was against him a year or so, two ago. And he said it was a cult. And so he was running from the cult. He ended up in Europe, and he called me in desperation that if I didn't send him some money, he would be dead in three days. So I sent him a couple thousand dollars, and he was supposedly forever grateful for that. And then I never heard from him. But a year later, he shows up. Just this past week, and let me see, this is entertaining. We're doing humor here, whatever it is, so you can learn something. I'm going to teach you something. Okay, so here it is. All right.
This is a conversation that was recorded?
No, emails. Emails.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so let's see. So he, out of the blue, he emails me. So he says, I'm homeless in Venice, California. talks about someone he ran into, says that person hates him. I know that. And he says, I will stay for a long, long time, I think. I have some illuminating essays coming out on Strauss. You know Leo Strauss?
Yeah.
Leo Strauss, father of neoconservatism, I guess, modern neoconservatism, and company. And he says, Adam Curtis just came out with a new documentary. And I said, yeah, I'm actually watching it right now. And then I say something about that, but I won't go into it. Then he writes back, McLuhan and Quadrophenia, citing me, now way more interesting to me, by the way. Where can I read about your new book? You have an interview on it, right? Thanks for the reference, you know, ahead of time. So I said, well, here's the book, and you can listen to me and Cameron. So let's see. I sent him the link to our discussions. And all of a sudden, maybe I missed it. He compliments me in one of these early emails. But all of a sudden, after he gets the link from you, and I don't know if he heard it, if he can, because he's, you know, sleeps in doorways at night and wanders around homeless working on his book, waiting for libraries to open so he can do more research. And he suddenly writes back to me, goes, I am calling it, you know less than me. Okay? Now, he used to do this years ago, flip on me. And then he sends another email. And he says, you're a Timocrat or Timocrat, T-I-M-O-C-R-A-T. I think he's being Wyndham Lewis. And, you know, I'm a guy who's stuck in time, like Ion says. You're a Timocrat or a Timocrat. And then he says, you're a Walter Alter even. Now, I don't know anything about Walter Alter other than he's a member of the Media Ecology list and he's always on there debating, but I don't know who he is. Then he says, you're an atheist. These are over a day he's making these emails. So then I said, I wrote back to him, so you didn't learn to drop your old BS when you were in that cult, that cost me $1,000 or something. And he goes, oh, fuck, really? I sincerely apologize to you and Carolyn. Thanks for informing me. Now, I don't know if he's joking when he says that, but let's see, to continue here. Just a second. He says, he wrote to me when I sent him the money, March 2020, a year ago. Bob, of all the intelligent people, or supposedly intelligent people that I correspond with, you are pretty much the only person that has proven to be a real human being. You have a heart of gold. Thank you so much, so much, so much to you and your wife for helping me in France and to this day, especially considering all that you have probably heard about me. You are the real deal, and keep on doing what you do for as long as it's possible. If I survive the next week, which is unlikely, so this is his final message to me, and if we ever meet again, which would still be unlikely, I hope to repay the favor. Unfortunately, I am not creative enough to do that right now. Okay, so he has a P.S. Might head to Australia soon if I can. Always been a dream. Always been a fan of the cinema, especially the work of George Miller. Take care. So I'm showing you, he thought a lot of me when I sent the money. Now it's a year later, and he's saying, Bob, if you are a Walter Alter, deranged, woman-hating, childless nerd, then I do not care what you have to say about anything. So then I say, so you haven't learned anything. You're still a spastic quadriplegic. Start paying me back or don't email me. He writes back, you're a joke. You've squandered your life and your profound gifts. Read Shakespeare's sonnets to his son. So I then say to him, do you remember how much money we gave you? He writes back the next day, okay, I regret the things I said. Please forgive me. So I say, you want to talk on the phone or Skype? So he says, yes. So we talk on the phone the other day. And that's nice. And then within, okay.
Maybe you should, just so that the readers or the hearers or auditors don't lose the thread, I'm kind of losing the thread. Why are we doing this?
You'll see. It totally relates to McLuhan's problems, why he had to be a comedian. So he sends, after, you know, saying, I'm an idiot, basically, he says, you know, I will be recognized as a saint sometime, meaning him. Then he says, the next day, Bob, I finally realized last night that you are insane and that I have been in denial about it for many years. he's finally realized he's been in denial. He's been really nice to me. He's been ignoring the fact that I'm insane. And then he says, you are perhaps the single greatest living proof that too much free time is dangerous. Perhaps your life has not been such a waste after all. I might write an essay explaining you to you. McLuhan would have loathed you. Maybe he did. Okay? So we're doing McLuhan here. And that's where he got. And I said, oh, I've looked forward to the essay. And I haven't heard back from him. But you see what I put up with, the abuse? McLuhan got letters like that all the time.
Sure. But that's the one thing that came to me through all this searching through the email and stuff is that for a long time, going back to your radio career and presumably before that, you kind of exist in not only a cloud of faces, but a cloud of voices.
Yes.
And you seem to me to be a kind of a special kind of microphone or a special kind of camera that can not only adjust the distance. Right, I mean, a microphone or a camera doesn't have any problem having a close-up, and then I forget what it's called when it's far away and it takes in the whole scene. But a microphone can also do the same thing, can pick up what somebody in a large scene is just sort of murmuring, and then go back and hear the entire kerfuffle of the entire scene, right?
Yeah.
So going back and forth. So what you can do is you can actually put on these individual voices, and then you can put on their ensemble.
Yes.
And so then and you've been doing this for at the very least 40 or 50 years.
That's right, 40 years.
That's right. And so that just the phenomenon is interesting.
Yeah.
Right? It's the exercise of mind shuffling cards, as I said before.
Yeah.
But you're not just shuffling cards. You're shuffling voices and masks. And not only is something objective, it's all, you also are doing it as something subjective.
Yes. And I've got, and 40 years of audio proving I did it.
Correct. And the tiny note chart is kind of a 1995 instancing of the
All the voices.
Putting on the mask, the fifth level, if you will, of the chart, the one that is the Bob Dobbs level, is putting on of a mask that is the collective mask. And so what you're doing there in terms of what we were speaking about earlier in McLuhan is that when McLuhan identifies forms that have their educational problems and their practical problems and their theoretical problems, he also identifies the problem of what he calls language itself.
Yeah.
Which is to say that there is, the thing that he probably liked most in Joyce was the idea that language is a kind of collective mask.
Yeah.
With its
own... That everybody contributes to.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And that is constantly changing, constantly adding new terms and new insights and new blindnesses.
Yeah.
But there are collective forms, and human history has not been very good at identifying those collective forms. We're much better at identifying individual forms, but when we apply the individual forms to the collective forms, then we get into trouble, right? Communism or Nazism or, manifest destinyism.
Joe Bidenism.
Yeah. Yeah, or Trumpism.
Yeah.
Right. All of these are applications of individual masks to the collective, and that's a bad and dangerous practice that human beings seem to be prone to.
Right. Let me just check. Did we hear a voice coming through there? Yeah, it's still happening, right? Just checking to see if we're still recording. What was your last bit? I know we got to end soon. But what was the last 10 words? All the voices, the mask.
Yeah, that there's
the individual mask makes a mistake going
humans,
collective.
Yeah, humans are prone to the mistake of applying individual masks, which they know to be plural. Two collectives, which they also know to be plural, but one of McLuhan's points is that those masks are different, and that we have to understand the masks of collectives.
The archetypes of the collective unconscious. That's what we're just learning.
Yeah.
We master the archetypes of individual postures of mind. He says that in Gutenberg Galaxy. Alexander Pope did a pretty good job anticipating Freud, he said. But now we're in the realm of the archetypes of the social unconscious while becoming collectively conscious. And so what's the difference? Now, by all that you said there, you reminded me that's probably what I thought I was doing when I made the chart. I was putting all the voices that I knew that I had done broadcast all on one page to look at, wow, look at all this stuff that I was referring to. And then also realizing that I was a nothing, so I brought in, I'm a subatomic particle. I'm also huge, so I brought in quasars and big cosmic phenomena. And then occult phenomena. Sociological phenomena. I put it all in there, so it was interesting what you just were saying. It reminded me, I think, of what I thought I was doing, putting all my voices on one page. And
That's an interesting phrase. It reminded me of what
I thought I was doing.
Yeah.
So it's like Joyce had the same experience with Finney's Wake. He started off with a certain, provincial goal with the book, and he never knew he'd be working on it for 17 years. And
for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
And we get out of control. Probably only stopped it because the looming of the Second World War.
Yeah.
Was wondering how he was going to continue it. So he said, fuck it, I'm going to stop it.
Yeah. And Ian says, good parts of it, better parts are on the cutting room floor. Like he just cobbled it together quickly. And there's a lot of stuff that got left out, unfortunately. And, you know, there are 25,000 pages in the Joyce archive.
Yeah, so they're...
that he did. 25,000 pages.
Yeah, so you're talking about the notebooks that they're...
Yeah, all the notebooks, all the galleys, everything, I guess. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As Ian says, we resemble that fact. I resemble Joyce. I understand what he got himself into. I made this chart, thought I was wrapping it up. Okay, here's the final statement, and I was just beginning. And here I am. What is this? 50?
All right, but today, as you say, we're at the end, but I think today is the first time that we came up with something remotely helpful in regards to the chart.
Yes.
And that is that it's a cloud of faces or memes that are speaking to and against and beyond each other, and you're going back and forth between identification with one or more and identification with the group of all, and the attempt is being made to understand this crazy collection of voices and faces.
Yes, and that's a page of Finnegan's Wake also. You know, I see Finnegan's Wake more and more over the last 20 years as the best portrait of where we've come to. And, of course, nobody would ever think that in the 30s. But this cacophony we live in and texting each other, there's so much of that in the Wake. Literally, it shows how people communicate now.
Yeah, or fail to communicate.
Yeah, fail, but what they neurotically keep doing. And it's almost, that's what he said, I'm going to make a book that appears never to end because that's what we're doing here, over-communicating and can't stop.
Yeah.
So
that could be called its horizontal dimension, and then there's the vertical dimension of where all this comes from.
You're looking for the vertical dimension of what I'm doing.
Correct.
Yeah. You're pretty good at laying out the horizontal aspects. Now, is there a vertical dimension? Yeah, that's maybe the next question.
Of Finnegan's Wake, or are you talking? Or
no, of
in
me,
general?
My chart, what I'm doing, my book.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that is the question.
Yes.
Right? That's actually where we started our conversation today, because I tried to set out what I called the McLuhan diagram. That's really a kind of vertical slice through the tiny note chart. My question to you was whether the question that I posed at the start of the conversation was whether what I was saying made sense or did not make sense.
Well, where's the ground? Was McLuhan the ground? I'd probably say Finnegan's Wake is the ground because, you know, it's used in the larger chart that the tiny note chart comes out of. So like McLuhan, I was trying to figure out what Finnegan's Wake meant. I added stuff that he didn't live long enough to add. So I was, what is that? That's a palimpsest or it's medieval commentary? You just sort of add to what other people said? You write over it or in the margins in their manuscript culture?
Yeah.
Yeah, the palimpsest maybe. I'm doing a palimpsest. Saying, okay, McLuhan got so far, but there's way more factors that need to be illustrated. And which is what I do in my book, you know, unused McLuhan or unused Finnegan's Wake is what
right.
I'm presenting.
Well, we'll go into that in detail.
Good.
That'd
be fine.
I think we might wrap up.
Yeah, you got to go.
The, Yeah, but let's just say that the question of what is going on in this cloud of memes and individual and collective voices and videos and all that sort of stuff is a very, very important question. But involved in the what is the how.
Yeah.
We can't overlook the fact that the whole question being posed of the what it inevitably raises the question of how to look, how to participate, how to think about, how to describe, that is always embedded in the what. And the what and the how go back and forth.
Okay, very good.
That
was a fun conversation. And
yes
I initiate, you brought up ION, you quoted ION, so we brought you into IONdom a little bit there. We started to initiate the tech body. ION announced that the tech body has overtaken ION. We got a problem here. Anyways, that's the most up-to-date. ION, did I ever tell you that the tech body was made up of 8/11th ION and 3/11th tech body? Remember me saying that?
Yeah, it's now up to 5/11th or something.
Yeah, well, it got to 6/11th ION and 5/11th. That's 3 weeks ago or so. 4 weeks ago. Well, ION announced that the tech body's got the upper hand. So it's sort of like tech body's 6/11th and ION's 5/11th. So on the show on Saturday, I came on and announced that ION has capitulated and I'm taking over from the tech body. So we'll see how that fares.
You're taking over from or taking over?
I'm taking over
against.
I'm taking over the role of protecting people from the tech body, which ION was doing, and they have capitulated. So I shocked ION by saying that I'm going to take over and do what you can't do anymore. So that's my challenge as of a week ago, less than a week ago. So anyways, that's the hopefully my book will be initiating you into how I got to this state of situation. And this is being said during the week that people are pronouncing me radically insane. And they sound pretty insane themselves, but apparently I'm worse off. Okay. Very good, Cameron. Fun
all
talking.
Right, Bob. Good to, look forward to the next time. Take care.
All right. You too. Bye.
Ciao, ciao.